We're talking with Dr. Earl Levin about his early career, his interest in planning, his education in planning, and what got him interested in the field to begin with.
My initial interest was not in planning, because planning was virtually unknown at that time in our areas. My original interest was in architecture. And I enrolled in the Faculty of Architecture at the University of Manitoba. I did the first year in that department, and then I went to war. And after the war, I came back to Winnipeg and to the University of Manitoba and completed my architectural degree. But my experience in England in the post-war year or so that I was there before coming back, there was an intense interest and a very, very broad wave of activity in the field of planning, simply because of the terrible devastation that had been wrought during the war. And the government created an agency with the title of the Association for Planning and Regional Reconstruction. And this awakened my interest in planning. Well, when I came back to Canada, I had married a London girl. I thought, well, why not give planning a go? I did have my architectural qualification, but I enrolled in the planning school at the University of British Columbia, and I got my master's degree in planning from the University of British Columbia. And then I thought, well, I think it would be very interesting to go back to England and see how things are going along there, seeing what's developing there. So in 1950, during the flood here, the enormous flood here, we made our way down through the United States and across to Montreal, and back to England. And I was really enthralled by the planning activity that was going on. And I thought, well, architecture is fine, but planning is finer. And I worked for the London County Council as a planner in the Barbican project and a number of other projects in the London area and around London.
Any new town projects?
Yeah, well, but the Barbican was a new town project. Yeah, that was fascinating. And when I came back, I thought, well, I'll embrace planning. But there wasn't a great deal of activity here in Canada by comparison. Nevertheless, it was growing. It was becoming of some interest. And I went on with my planning career from there. But for the most part, in fact, for the totality of it, it was here in Canada, all the way from Victoria to Newfoundland, in one capacity or another. Yeah. If I wasn't actually a planner at the board, creating the concepts, I was a member of a society of one kind or another, and that's been my career. In Victoria, I wasn't a planner as such, employed as such, but I was a member of the the board of directors of the city of Victoria, and advised them on the planning aspects. And I was a member of the board of directors of the Fairfield Community Association, which was a local association, and a member of the planning committee there. And it was an experience there that ended my career in that particular capacity, because on one occasion, a member of the association who was an architect brought in a plan for a house which he had designed. Sometime previous to that, the municipality, at least the community of Gonzales, which is adjacent to Fairfield, the two of them, Fairfield Gonzales, are often considered as a unity. But Gonzales had a plan prepared, a local plan prepared. But at the same time, there was a zoning bylaw that covered a large area, including Gonzales and Fairfield and others as well. Well, this chap brought in his plan, and it proposed to put a house, his house, this design, on a lot, a vacant lot, in Gonzales. But the zoning bylaw allowed the house. Let me back up for a moment. The community association planning group, that is the members of the association who formed the association, the Fairfield Association's planning group, were all middle class and all single family dwellings. And when he brought in his plan, they turned it down. And I said, well, just a moment. There is a zoning bylaw which allows multiple dwellings in this area. And there's no reason in the world why you shouldn't agree, shouldn't accept the jurisdiction of the zoning bylaw.
Right.
Since there isn't and this was for Fairfield. The plan was for a property in Fairfield and not in Gonzales. And I said, well, there isn't a plan for Fairfield, but there is a zoning bylaw that covers it, and the zoning bylaws allows this to proceed. They said, we don't like it, and the plan doesn't allow it. So I said, good, adieu. You can have your convictions and your preferences, but this doesn't make any sense at all, and there's no point in my belonging to this group, because you just don't know what it's all about.
Right.
And that persuaded me to write a little brief, which I called, The Development Plan and the Zoning Dilemma. And it was a discussion of the relationship between the development plan and the zoning bylaw, a discussion in which I pointed out, in my view, that the zoning bylaw really didn't have the primary authority if there were a plan established. The zoning bylaw's job was to support the development plan and to make sure that whatever new development came in, not only if it weren't that kind of thing, were not yet developed in the community. Nevertheless, the zoning bylaw would support it. And in any case, where there was a zoning bylaw and a development plan, the zoning bylaw simply was a supportive document to make sure that the development plan's proposals were honored and were observed. Yes. That was it. And I said, well, ta-ta. And I withdrew from the planning committee. Yeah.
So you gave them this brief to read, or you delivered it as a speech?
No, I gave it to them to read.
Yeah. Did you get any response from them about it?
Some, yeah. Some. Yeah. I think it clarified some of the questions, but the general attitude of the residents in the Fairfield community was a very middle class, very opposed to change, mm-hmm. not interested in change, not interested in the future. They liked it as it was. Mm-hmm. And as it was, they wanted it to remain.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you listen to students talking about their projects and the kind of consultation they want to do. They have a very rosy view of citizen participation and how important it is and how positive it is and wanting that community involvement. But it, I guess some of them don't realize that there can be that other side.
Well, it varies. It depends on where it is, which community it is. Some communities are more open to change than other communities. And I found that generally in Winnipeg, there's very little openness to the prospects of radical changes, mm-hmm. great changes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's at that time, and particularly at that time, when the whole concept of zoning was just in its infancy, or the concept of planning rather, mm-hmm. was just in its infancy. And now, I don't know how many years later, 60 years later, I suppose, 56 years later, it hasn't changed all that much. Mind you, Winnipeg has had a varied kind of history, mm-hmm. in terms of municipal structure and all of the consequences that flow from the particular kind of municipal structure. Mm-hmm. But even so, it hasn't really opened their eyes to future possibilities.
Well, why don't we go into your experiences then in Winnipeg as the head of planning for Metro. Can you tell us a bit about your experiences, what the issues were that you had to deal with and the challenges?
Well, I don't know whether I can, actually. It was a period of great confusion. Great confusion. The I suppose one should go back to the beginning of Winnipeg with the Selkirk settlers. It was in, 1812 that the Selkirk settlers came and settled on the west bank of the Red River and became known as the Red River Colony or the Red River Community. But at the same time, there was some immigration, quite a bit of people coming in, and there was this whole series of changes implemented by the provincial government, in which there was the legislation which created municipalities. There was a legislation which created the province of Manitoba, the legislation which created the metropolitan government. And it was during the the period of between the two wars, the end of the 1914-1918 war and the end of the 1939-45 war, there was tremendous population growth. That growth had some interesting characteristics. The south and west part of the city was populated by people mainly from England, mainly with that kind of Anglo-Saxon, English, Scottish sort of background. And the north and east was populated by other ethnic groups, other ethnicities. And one of the sad events was the approval of the railway cutting right across the whole area, which completely segregated the north from the south. And the residents respectively pursued different kinds of ethnic and other cultural goals and cultural objectives. For the most part, the people who came from with the Anglo-Saxon background were businessmen, mm-hmm. and were interested mainly in the economy and in business development. And of course, they had the fur trade, the preceding fur trade, as an example of what might be possible, because the fur trade was an extremely successful activity. And the people on the north had different points of view altogether, and were not able really to make cultural, linguistic, and even ethnic contact with the people in the south for quite a long time. And so you had two different kinds of urbanities, if you like, that evolved. And those differences are apparent today. The area generally north of the tracks, the railway tracks, in the north end, has quite a different character and different quality from the area south of the tracks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, one of the additional problems was the fact that there were so many agencies that provincial government created to do particular kinds of jobs. Mm-hmm. For example, when they created the municipalities were given the responsibility for streets and services. But when the metropolitan government was created, they'd given the responsibility for planning. Whatever plan it made, it could be negated, could be completely destroyed simply because of the fact that the municipalities that were involved had the power to create or to approve the street system and the connections and the servicing. So it was a ridiculous sort of situation. And it explains in large measure why the metropolitan government was able to produce virtually no planning whatsoever. Because you had that impossible situation in which if you were dealing with the municipal area around the city of Winnipeg, which was created in 1873, and the surrounding municipalities, Winnipeg, the metropolitan Winnipeg, had the authority, so to speak, to create a plan for the metropolitan area, but the component municipalities could simply put it down the drain because all they had to do was say, oh no, we can't approve the street system, or we can't approve this sewage and water system, or we can't approve the connections between the streets. So the metropolitan government succeeded in virtually nothing. Mm. You know, it had very little success. Matter of fact, I can't think of. Well, there was Metropolitan Winnipeg was produced, but it was not a plan.
No.
For the most part, the whole concept of planning during that period, and even today, I suppose, is now focused and not tomorrow focused.
Mm-hmm.
The whole difficulty with the planning function in Winnipeg is that for the most part, the people who had the economic and the financial and energy were not interested in the future. They were interested in the present and what the exploitation that was possible in the economy at the present time. And there was no concern about the future. And the problem was that there wasn't a future-oriented development plan produced in the whole history of the city of Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of criticism about Plan Winnipeg that it isn't really a plan.
No,
as such.
No. I mean, it's what is it? It's a scheme for developing roads and for controlling the location of certain kinds of development. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But not future at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You participated in the Winnipeg Area Transportation Study during that period, which, looking at it now, it's so ambitious with its looking at rail lines and freeways, and was this culture that you're talking about, was that partly what contributed to it not being implemented?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The business community just didn't give a damn about the implementation, and they were the majority in the south of the tracks. And before the tracks came in, they were enthralled by the possibility of the CNR coming in, CPR coming in into the city, because at one time the railways proposed not coming to Winnipeg at all. They were going to come across farther north.
Oh.
Yeah. But I suppose the urgency that was expressed by the Winnipeggers was effective, and the railway came down through Winnipeg, but it came right through Winnipeg, and it could have been a much more effective facility if it had been more carefully worked out, and if the driving force behind it, the full driving force behind it, was not the business community. The railway itself would have gone wherever it was most appropriate and most economical. But the pressures that were exerted by the community, the business community in Winnipeg, brought it to Winnipeg and brought it across the city of Winnipeg. And there was an opportunity that was lost there. But it might have been much more effective. And the segregation, the separation, if you like, between the Europeans in the north and the British in the south, might have been a different picture altogether, a different sort of situation. There might have been closer cohesion between the two groups.
So not only was there fragmentation between Winnipeg and the other adjacent municipalities, but also fragmentation within Winnipeg.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the greatest dividing force, the reason for the fragmentation, was the creation of Metro, in which the city of Winnipeg was did not have the same authority as the metropolitan government, and the city of Winnipeg gave rise to Stephen Juba, and the altercation, the antagonism between the city of Winnipeg and the Metropolitan Council was, I think, in very large measure an expression of the personal feelings of the mayor of the city of Winnipeg. Ultimately, of course, achieved his objective, became the mayor of
Unicity.
But there was a terrible, terrible period of conflict in which he exhibited the most violent kind of personality and demands and opinions. However,
was any of this antagonism directed against the head of Metro Planning?
No, not at all. Because the head of Metro Planning was not able to accomplish anything that affected the city of Winnipeg. And he knew damn well that whatever the planning of the metropolitan government might do, he had the authority to simply negate it. All he had to do was say that we're simply not going to approve that street system. Or we're not going to approve that sewer and water system. Shut it.
If anything, then Unicity, I guess they were calling him the super mayor after Unicity. I guess that only that didn't improve.
Well, I don't think that the city has improved, but the reason they called it Unicity was because of there was no longer the separation between the Metropolitan Authority and the City of Winnipeg Authority. It was all unified.
Was there optimism at the time that so much of this fragmentation and lack of coordination, that the planning function in Winnipeg would finally be able to achieve some positive...
Not that I was aware of. There was no... There was no real understanding of the essential quality and nature of the planning function.
Mm-hmm.
There was no understanding that it was a future-oriented function in important measure. It was not only present and past, but it looked to the future. And the preparation of a plan was partly premised on the expectations of what to expect within the next decade or whatever that period might have been as defined. Mind you, nobody can foresee the future. Nobody knows what the hell is going to happen. But nevertheless, if you have a conception based upon the existing conditions, the existing situation, the existing impetus, and you are able to, on the basis of the existing situation, analyze what is likely to happen over the next period of time, specified period of time, you can then make proposals for achieving that ultimate period of time in the form in which you have envisioned it. But if you find that along the way it's not going the way you had thought, then you have the opportunity to revise and mm-hmm. change mm-hmm. until finally the period comes when you may not realize exactly what it was that you had 10 years ago in mind,
mm-hmm.
but nevertheless there is a coordinated development and the place is functioning fairly smoothly and people are getting along quite well,
mm-hmm.
and most people are very pleased with the city they're living in.
Mm-hmm. That would be nice. Now, you left being the head of planning in 72 just as Unicity had taken effect. What was behind that move? What did you end up doing after that?
Oh, I continued as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I worked for a variety of consultancies
mm-hmm.
in a variety of cities, and ultimately established my own consultancy.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of very good companies, and I had fairly good appointments in mm-hmm. each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was Jameson Smith, and there was a number of them,
right.
And I had senior appointments in each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was the planner, even though initially I suppose the thrust wasn't so much in planning, although there was some,
mm-hmm.
but it was mainly in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out very well.
Yes.
It worked out very well indeed.
Yeah, quite a remarkable career. And one of the aspects, of course, that's of interest because we have the collection of all of your papers here is you had an extraordinary aspect of your career delivering speeches, some 70 papers, very articulate, eloquent speeches. How did you start being recognized for this? You mentioned you wrote this brief for this community where there was this dispute over zoning, but was that one of the first of those kinds of papers? Or?
No, that didn't have any publicity at all.
Mm.
That paper was purely for the Fairfield Community Association planning group.
Right.
Papers. Well, damn it if I can remember how I had my first invitation to talk, but it was simply as a result of, as a planner, inevitably one had to have contact with the community,
mm-hmm.
and that community contact was not limited to the council, the city council or the town council.
Mm-hmm.
That community contact involved companies in that community, different kinds of businesses, different kinds of enterprises. And I suppose that it was through that particular avenue that I was invited in each case, mm-hmm. rather than through the council itself.
Mm-hmm. A very diverse range of organizations. Outdoor Advertising Association, and others. I'm struck in reading your papers, the oratorical style, very sophisticated, I guess, compared to a lot of speeches I've heard or read. I'm curious, did you take rhetoric in school, oratory? No?
No, but my earliest interest was in literature.
Mm.
And I read very, very widely, mm-hmm. and I loved books.
Mm-hmm.
That, I suppose, had an effect on my language.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of your more, which writers had more influence on you, would you say?
Oh, I don't think there was any of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the classical ones, and the American ones, and the British, the English, I enjoyed
mm-hmm.
them all.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was at UBC doing my planning course, there was a member of the faculty of UBC who was an anthropologist by the name of Wayne Suttles. He had a wife whose name was Shirley Suttles, but she was a writer. She wrote under the name of Leslie Conger. And somehow or another, we became very closely associated with each other, the two, man and wife and man and wife. But the closer association was with Shirley and me, because Wayne was an anthropologist and was interested in the Aboriginal people in Canada, well, in Canada and in America, in North America, and became an expert in Aboriginal languages. But Helen wasn't interested in Aboriginal languages, and I was only interested in the English language. But Shirley was a writer, and she wrote, and somehow or another, we became associated in writing novels and in writing short stories. And it went on during the period that I lived in on the campus at the University of British Columbia. Until I was lured away by the offer of employment somewhere as a planner, I suppose. And then Wayne, of course, went back to the United States and has published a number of books on the Aboriginal languages, etc. But when we came to Winnipeg in 2006, you know, a year ago, there was an awful lot of stuff, an enormous amount of goods that came with that move, because it was the goods from three dwellings. It was my dwelling in Victoria, and my son's dwelling in Victoria, and my son's wife's dwelling in Winnipeg, because she had... She had been offered a residency at the Health Sciences Center here in Winnipeg. She was a doctor in Brazil. I don't know whether this is relevant or not. But David was on the staff, on the faculty of the University of Victoria. And somehow or another, a group from the University of Victoria was invited, was asked more than just an invitation, to come over to Brazil, to this particular city in Brazil, because there was a problem there. Mm-hmm. That they might, the University of Victoria people might be of help. And it was there that David, my son, met Giovanna, who was a practicing physician and part of that group. Well, they were more than part of that group. They became husband and wife eventually, David and Giovanna. And she came back to Victoria with David. And for 5 years, she applied for a license to practice medicine in Canada and was refused. Mm-hmm. And she was having a really not a very encouraging time. And then, ultimately, on the sixth year, she was given an offer from Halifax and from Winnipeg. And she chose Winnipeg. So she moved to Winnipeg into the Health Sciences Center to do her residency. David remained in Victoria, but applied for an appointment to the University of Manitoba. And ultimately, he got it. Mm-hmm. He was appointed to the University of Manitoba. Giovanna had a 5-year residency program that she had to complete, which she just completed a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So now she's a fully fledged MD here and can practice with a license and as a qualified forensic psychiatrist, etc., etc. But the point is that when David, when my wife died last summer, in April, David was still living in Victoria, and I was still living in Victoria. And when David got his appointment here in Manitoba, he said, well, why don't you come and join us? Mm-hmm. Well, they talked and they tried and they twisted and they said, oh, I said, all right, I'll come and join you. And packed up everything from our Victoria residence and everything from his Victoria residence and brought it over here. And in sorting it out, I came across 4 newspaper clippings containing each containing a short story by Leslie Conger and Michael Aaron, my student. Huh. And we hadn't been in touch for a hell of a long time. And here was this connection back. Hmm. So I immediately wrote to Shirley and told her about the short stories and recollections, etc. So that was it. But as far as my rhetorical style is concerned, I don't know.
I was trying to imagine some of these speeches given with PowerPoint, as is the practice today, and I just wasn't seeing it. It does seem to be a kind of a different.
Never had any formal training in the delivery of ideas at all, speeches. Natural, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You mentioned also something earlier about when you were in Winnipeg and moving, you know, beyond being at the head of planning. And one of those activities was being a senior fellow with the Institute of Urban Studies. Can you tell us about that period, please?
No.
Okay.
No, I suppose. Yeah. How the hell did I become involved with Ellen Arterby's? I think I seem to think that it occurred during a period when I was at a loose end. Mm-hmm. I think that I had left one of my appointments and had not yet been invited to another one, and I had been in touch with Alan anyway, with Alan Arterby's, and because of this period of laxity, I suppose, He said, "Well, why don't you come and take the role of a senior fellow?" I said, "No, that would be very nice." And I enjoyed the stay. I produced a couple of papers, I think four papers while I was here, and a plan for some community. I've forgotten which community. And then the appointment that I was waiting for came through, and so I said to Alan, "Well, thank you very much, and let's retain our relationship, but I think I have to join this company, this firm." And we had a kind of an interesting, not very intimate, but a relationship. And then later on, he wondered whether I would like to come back to the Institute, not as a senior fellow, but as a research associate.
Mm.
Well, which enabled me to retain my appointment, my regular job, and to work with Alan as a research associate. And that was interesting too. I think we produced some interesting documents during that period. is it all right?
Oh yeah, it looks good.
But since Alan became an American, I haven't had any contact with him at all.
Right.
Have you?
No, I think maybe about a book review once, but this would have been when the Institute was over at Graham Hall, was it?
Yeah. How, well, behind the main building somewhere.
Right.
Not in this building.
No. How big a staff were there at the time?
I have no idea.
Okay.
No idea how many people. You mean in the Institute?
Yeah.
How many are there now?
Five.
I don't know how many there were, but I don't think that there were more than five.
Oh, okay.
No. I don't think there were as many as five.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, well, I shouldn't say because I don't know. I would hazard a nebulous sort of guess that there were three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Alan and somebody to type and that right. sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. The doctoral dissertation that you did late in your career. Can you talk about how you arrived at your research plan to do such a massive study about planning in Canada in three cities?
Well, I had worked in I don't know how many cities, a hell of a lot of cities, right across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if I hadn't actually worked in them, I didn't do any actual work in Newfoundland. What's the capital of Newfoundland?
St. John's.
St. John's, yeah. I didn't do any work in St. John's, but I knew the planning director there, and I was invited to attend various kinds of meeting, institutional meetings and other kinds of meetings. But I had worked in, I've lived and worked in eight cities.
Mm-hmm.
But I have worked in an additional, another eight perhaps, or more, ten perhaps, in between.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came to the point when I had nothing else to do. I thought, well, you know, why don't I do a doctoral degree? Because
mm-hmm.
I never really had a lot of respect for, well, not a question of not having a lot of respect. I just didn't have the time or the interest in academic life. I was much more interested in professional life out in the field. And time came when I thought, well, all right, let's try academic life for a while. Mm-hmm. I'll try to do a doctoral degree. And obviously, there wasn't any choice. Well, there was a choice, but Saskatchewan was one of my first places to work. Winnipeg, another. And Calgary was another one, but not that I had any contact with Calgary at all, but the idea of a prairie program was really what set me off, planning on the prairies, and because I was most familiar with Winnipeg and Regina, spent a lot of time there. And I thought, well, all right, why not look at the whole sort of historical evolution of the planning idea on the prairies and how it came to express itself specifically in these three contact points of the prairies, Winnipeg, Regina, and Calgary. And so I thought, well, why not? There's an awful lot of data available for all of them. So I jumped into it. And it was a very pleasant activity. I enjoyed preparing the dissertation. But I have a copy of it somewhere, and I can't find it. I don't know where it is. Hmm. There are some 850 pages, 840 pages, I don't know, something like that. And I thought, well, this is not a bad chunk of work. I wonder if it might be turned into a book. So I talked to whoever it was at the University of Manitoba, and who the hell was the planning head there at that time?
Was it Gorecki?
Who?
Kent Gorecki?
Could be, I'm not sure. Anyway, I was advised to write to this group in Regina, which apparently was the kind of editorial group, they performed the editorial function of doctoral theses, but I don't know whether they took every doctoral thesis or whether there were other editorial groups that were involved in the same sort of activity or not. But I said, well, all right, I'll try the Regina group. And I sent them the 839, 40 pages. And they got back to me and they said, you'll have to reduce this if you want to make a book out of it. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, the hell with that. I said, I can't be bothered anymore with this.
How many years did it take to
How
complete?
How many years?
Yeah.
Quite a few years. Mm-hmm. Where was I living when it started? Was I living here in Winnipeg? Well, I must have been. I must have done the whole thing here in Winnipeg when I lived in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. What year did I complete it?
Wasn't it
93? 93?
Yeah.
Yeah, 93 was... It was 93 when I got my doctorate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it must have been somewhere around 93. Mm-hmm. I must have started it in maybe 85. Mm-hmm. It may have taken me 8 years, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I spend a lot of time, a lot of the time, maybe 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, come on, let's cut it back. Right. Maybe 5 or 6 years.
Wow. Remarkable. But the academic world, you'd also had experience in that as the head of the city planning program at the University of Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you there?
4 years.
Yeah.
No. I think it was 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
3 years.
Mm-hmm.
3 years.
How many courses did you teach?
Just one, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one. Yeah. I had a staff of four, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was a staff of four.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very competent. They were good staff. I'm not sure that I think I taught only one course.
Mm-hmm. Which one would that have been?
Well, the nature of planning,
okay.
The fundamental one.
Theory?
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. What?
But I found that I wasn't really all that interested in academia.
Mm-hmm.
I was much more involved and drawn into the professional activity,
mm-hmm,
of the actual preparation of plans in communities, working with communities, than I was in,
mm-hmm,
the academic side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, it was a, a subgroup of the Faculty of Architecture. And the Faculty of Architecture wasn't really very interested in the planning function at all.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care for the head of the faculty very much. And there wasn't a great deal of interchange between the architectural side of it and the planning side of it.
No, I was really struck by that when I was studying. I had expected that architecture students and planning and landscape students would all... We never met. We never talked. It was...
No.
Yeah.
And mind you, you were more recent than I was. Imagine what it was like in,
mm-hmm,
my time,
mm-hmm,
when planning was just a kind of
yeah,
a pastime.
Mm-hmm.
An idea.
Right.
Yeah. No, it was... It wasn't a very gratifying 3 years. It,
mm-hmm,
was 3 years, I think. I'm,
mm-hmm,
not sure. I think it was 3 years.
Hmm.
I could check my...
Yeah.
But I didn't care for it very much. And then at the end, there was... I'm very suspicious of this. At the end, there was the expectation that the funding... for the planning function, the planning division, wouldn't be available,
mm-hmm,
in the next year.
Mm.
So, now, whether that was just a device to get me to resign or not,
mm,
I don't know. And I don't really care very much one way or the other.
Right.
But apparently there was,
mm-hmm,
a threat of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
A shortage of funding, and the architectural faculty, of course, would cut the planning,
mm-hmm,
department,
mm-hmm,
as a first priority, mm-hmm, as a first economy.
Right.
So it may well be that the architectural faculty didn't have the funding in hand,
mm-hmm,
to continue,
mm-hmm,
into the next year.
Right.
And so I left.
Yeah. Okay. In your time there and your experience with the dissertation and perhaps contact with academia since, do you have some thoughts on the state of planning education in Canada?
Well, I suppose the basic thought underlying all of my attitudes towards the planning function is that it's still nebulous, that there isn't any real, at least not in my experience, any real linkage between the future orientation and the past orientation in the present. The planning function is still looked on as a matter of land use and zoning, and not of community future, community well-being. The realization of dreams, the realization of hopes, of expectations, in a particularly articulate form. It's still very much as it always has, as it used to be, well, as it was in recent years. And that is a matter of land use and zoning, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I think particularly here in Winnipeg, and mind you, I've spent the latter years in Winnipeg, so I really can't say what the function of the planning department is in Regina at the present time, although I don't think it has changed all that much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, Regina is a different situation. It's a much smaller community and much less industrially developed and that sort of thing. Calgary, again, is a completely different one. That is a completely different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And their future was the future of oil.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really see that the function of planning as an expectation, a dip into the future, hopefully, and the articulation of that particular vision with the existing situation and the historical situation doesn't seem to be part of the academic role of the planning department.
Mm.
It's too bad.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find it?
I certainly see some nebulousness.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a career in librarianship, and I was a professional librarian for almost 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
And having gone through graduate school there, and then in the profession.
Where?
In the University of Alberta, and I worked
in Calgary.
Edmonton and Calgary. And there's a lot of professional angst in librarianship. What is our role? What role will we be playing in the future? How is technology impacting our profession? The public doesn't know what we do. There's no recognition and respect for librarianship. And I thought, you know what? I'm getting tired of this debate. I think I want to go into a profession that knows what it's doing. And I go into planning, and the same debate.
Exactly the same.
Same confusion.
Exactly the same. You should have stayed in the library. No, not necessarily.
It's good now I've got two professions that I don't really know what I'm doing with. So.
Yeah, well, that is my view of the current academic planning role.
Mm-hmm.
The planning role is being propounded in academia.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't changed very much. There isn't any. But then, where can one find the articulation of the future, future expectation, future hopes, in an articulate kind of form? I don't know where you can find it, really, in our society.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much anxiety about all the various crises we've been facing for the last number of decades.
Sure.
The futurelessness.
Yeah.
That kind of creeps into the culture and no expectation that there's going to be anything to plan for, so why bother?
Well, perhaps we'll phone to that. That is the situation. That what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
What will be, will be. But I think it's a shame in a way, because no, of course, nobody can foresee what the hell the future holds. Mm-hmm. There's just no way in which you can accurately forecast what's going on. But we've gone over this already. It doesn't matter. What you can foresee, what you can do, mm-hmm. is project present hopes, present expectations, mm-hmm. over a fixed period of time, and then monitor it to see whether it's going to be or not. Mm-hmm. And that should really be the planning function. And there should be a particular subject in the planning school that deals with the articulation of expectations and the monitoring function of that articulation in terms of what in fact is happening. Well, you can't really tell because the future is not here yet. Mm-hmm. But the academic side of it, the teaching side of it, I think should have a much greater presence in the program than it has at the present time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, but you do teach, don't you?
Yes, I do.
What do you teach?
I teach the thesis preparation course, and I teach a history of the city course that is mostly populated with undergraduate environmental design students, but does have one or two grad students per term. But I've always found it a little frustrating that history of the city is not a required course for planning students. they really ought to have that knowledge.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And the other course I teach in environmental design is environmental psychology. But
psychology?
Environmental psychology.
You mean, does the environment have a psychology?
Well, the ED,
the psychology
students,
about the environment.
Yeah, how people react,
perception,
perceive it, react to it, yeah. And graduate students in city planning who come through the environmental design program have that course. But students who come into planning from other disciplines don't have that.
No.
And they don't have the option to take it, which is another thing that I think is a real shortcoming in the planning program here. And I've argued with Ian White, oh, not argued, but I've said to Ian White that there ought to be an option for grad students to
is this the natural environment that you're talking
natural
about?
Natural and built. What are the characteristics that facilitate people to be able to wayfind successfully in a space, to feel comfortable, you know, even in lighting, acoustics?
Yeah, well, as long as the environmental side of it is not neglected, that's fine. But I think that for a planning student to concentrate on the natural environment without
right.
any,
it
doesn't
no.
make much sense.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that the point is that in the city, there is an inevitable fusion of the natural environment
mm-hmm.
and the urban environment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the side that ought to be emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the natural environment as it was and as it becomes and as you perceive it
mm-hmm.
as the urban environment
mm-hmm.
moves in and takes over that mm-hmm. particular space.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, not entirely, because there's still, I mean, Winnipeg has a tremendous connection to the natural environment,
mm-hmm.
except that it is now a phony natural environment that is
mm-hmm.
it's not
yeah.
not left to nature. It's
yeah.
a contrived natural environment.
Yes.
But the trees and the landscaping
mm-hmm.
are there, and
mm-hmm.
they're important elements in the urban environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sure.
And nature has to adapt to what we've done to it.
Well,
yeah.
nature says, to hell with you, I'm moving.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
going somewhere
yeah.
else.
Okay, we're probably about out of time for today. We should probably wrap it up for today. So,
all right.
Thank you very much.
How much time have we spent? Half an hour?